Okay, here we go. Okay, so my topic is, why has recognition of Gulf War illness taken so long? And I'm sorry we don't have a bigger crowd, but that doesn't matter. Those of you here are very important, and we'll have our session anyway. I've actually was happy when Dr. Schechter asked me to give this talk, because I've wanted to address this topic for a long time, and this gave me an opportunity to sort of pull together a lot of thoughts that I've had and try to think this out systematically. Because through the years, we've seen a lot of denial in the U.S. government about illnesses that relate to war. It's selective denial. Sometimes there are some illnesses and injuries related to war are very carefully acknowledged and addressed. Others are denied and not addressed. And so I'm interested in this topic and was happy to be able to pull it together. Okay. So, first of all, I have no relationships to disclose, no conflicts of interest over this topic. Okay, well, what is the Gulf War illness? Well, it's chronic fatigue, cognitive problems, memory attention problems, word finding issues, personality change, sensory problems, that is pain in the joints and tingling and numbness in the extremities, balance disturbances, vertigo attacks, autonomic dysregulation, unrefreshing sleep, skin rashes, sexual dysfunction, and many other symptoms. These are the main ones. And you can imagine when many soldiers came back from the 1991 Gulf War complaining of this, that they were not it was not recognized as an illness right away. However, within a few months after the war, there were such a large number of people coming back with these symptoms. In fact, in a minute I'll show you, about a quarter of the force came back with this chronic problem. And so several scientific committees were formed that reviewed the problem immediately within the first couple of years after the war. And they came up with this list of possible causes. Organophosphate chemical weapon exposure, warfare agents like sarin and cyclosarin that were released by our bombing of the Iraqi chemical weapon production and storage facilities, and large numbers of people were exposed to the fallout from that bombing. Pesticide spraying, organophosphate pesticides on the uniforms to prevent mosquito exposure, DEET insect repellents. Pyridostigmine is an organophosphate-like chemical that the soldiers were taking as a medicine to prevent the effects of nerve gas, the fatal effects, antibiotics, multiple immunizations, and then a lot of other environmental exposures. These were cataloged, and it was thought that this could potentially cause an encephalopathy, a chronic illness, but we didn't know exactly how, and so it really didn't go anywhere. And we're now approaching the 20th, we're in the middle of the 20th anniversary of the 1991 Gulf War, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And at this time, an estimated 25% of the 700,000 deployed force have chronic, fatiguing, painful cognitive illness that has not gone away. Over $500 million, $500 million, has been spent on research and disease registries from that war. However, no diagnostic test exists, and there's no treatment for this. And only about 3,000 of the 175,000, see, 25% of 700,000 is 175,000. Of these, only 3,000 are acknowledged of having an illness by the VA, or service connected for this condition. And Gulf War veterans as a group are the most unhappy group of veterans that attend the VA, our VA Veterans Healthcare System. Most are angry over their VA healthcare, and most VA physicians are frustrated to see them coming because they don't know what to do with these people. And so you can see 20 years later, we have not recognized this as an illness, and these soldiers, if they are ill, if this is really an illness, are not being served. Now, why? Well, here's an interesting study there was a literature review that pulled together the seven large studies, or large and small studies, in which they studied both the deployed force, the 700,000 that were deployed, and the non-deployed force, and estimated the prevalence of that illness. And they found, regardless of the case, they used all different case definitions of the illness, and regardless of how common they found the illness, if you subtract the non-deployed prevalence from the prevalence in the deployed, and you get the risk difference, that difference is between 20% and 30%, and an average of 26%. So it appears that about 26% of the force has an illness that's attributable to the war that meets this case definition of chronic fatiguing, cognitive, painful illness. Now, so the current working hypothesis for a number of years has been that this is a chronic encephalopathy, something that affected the brain. It involves both white matter and deep gray matter. It's similar to that seen in pesticide-exposed workers, workers who spray pesticides and develop this same type of illness. It's caused by exposure to organophosphate chemicals, is the theory, particularly low-level sarin nerve gas liberated by our coalition bombing of Iraqi storage sites, enhanced by co-exposure with pesticides and pyridostigmine bromide anti-nerve gas medication, which has been shown in animal studies to potentiate the long-term effects of organophosphate exposure, pesticide and nerve gas exposure. It will prevent deaths immediately from organophosphate exposure, but it will potentiate the long-term effects, increase the long-term effects. Now, in groups of veterans with a genetic susceptibility to organophosphate chemical injury, is thought to add to this problem. In fact, there is a particular gene called the PON gene, stands for para-oxinase. The PON1 gene has a polymorphism called the Q192R polymorphism. So you're either a Q form or an R form or a QR heterozygote. And if you're the Q form, you're highly resistant to nerve gas exposure. If you have the R form or the heterozygous form, you're more susceptible to the effects of nerve gas. Okay? And so this polymorphism has been studied, and as I'll show you in a minute, there is a strong association with Gulf War illness and this polymorphism, which protects you from nerve gas, thus strengthening the hypothesis that the illness is due to low-level nerve agent. However, at this point, there's no diagnostic test. However, studies on advanced brain imaging, neuroimaging, and neuropsychological testing appear promising. We may be close to a diagnostic test, and there's no treatment. However, drugs that block brain inflammation, neuroinflammation, are soon to be tested and appear that this may be a treatment that would roll back the disease and reduce the symptoms, but not proven yet. So anyway, there's been progress, but still no acknowledgement by the government that this is a real illness. Now, just to show you some of the advanced brain imaging findings, one of the symptoms of Gulf War illness is that the veterans who have this illness have trouble remembering things. For example, I talk to many of these veterans, take a medical history, and they all tell you, when I go into the next room to try to do something, by the time I get in the next room, I don't remember why I went in there. And my wife is always having to remind me of what I thought I was doing. And they go to the store and they can't remember why they went to the store. Well, that's been, many doctors disbelieve that. They believe the veterans are making this up because otherwise they appear normal and they can speak normally and carry on conversations and remember things that happened years ago, but they can't remember what they're doing now. Well, now, in recent studies comparing well veterans here at the top with sick Gulf War veterans, this is a functional MRI study, fMRI, where you put people in the scanner and have them remember something that that you had them learn earlier. And while they're trying to remember, a well person, colored area is the area called the hippocampus. It's the part of the brain that actually does remembering, that carries out the memory function. And when a person is trying to remember a task, little parts of the hippocampus light up, indicated by the red dots. Those are areas that are functioning when they're trying to remember something in the scanner. Whereas, and this is, well, Gulf War veterans have this normal response in the hippocampus, whereas sick veterans, you don't see that response in the hippocampus, indicating that there is malfunction of the hippocampus when they are trying to remember something. So this is suggesting now that the first evidence that the symptoms of Gulf War illness are real, have to do with real brain malfunction or brain injury to these deep structures. Another set of brain imaging studies, this is a subtraction image, an image that compares brain structure in sick Gulf War veterans, subtracting out what you see in well veterans. And this is a particular type of scan called diffuser tensor imaging, or DTI. And the real dark images are the very light things, and the dark blue here. All these areas are areas of white matter, of myelinated areas, that are abnormal in the sick veterans compared to the well veterans. Now you see there's widespread abnormality of white matter, and this is very similar to what the Japanese have seen with the same type of imaging in people who survived the sarin attack in the Tokyo subway that you may remember from the Anshin Rikyo cult. And they have similar symptoms to Gulf War veterans. So we now have a marker of white matter disease in these sick Gulf War veterans that would explain some of the particularly pain symptoms and so forth. And finally, we have this polymorphism. This is the odds ratio for the association of Gulf War illness with having heard a question on a survey called having heard chemical weapon alarms while you were serving in the war. If you heard the chemical weapon alarms, then you would be more likely have a higher relative risk for having the Gulf War illness later. Whereas this are strata of how well the degree of protection from nerve gas from this pond gene that I mentioned. And so if you have very high protection, that is you have a high level of that Q form of the enzyme, then you have a very low relative risk, only about a twofold increase in illness if you heard the chemical weapon alarms. Whereas if you had the lowest protection, that is you had the R form of the gene, and very low protection against nerve gas, and you heard the chemical alarms, that gave you a ninefold increase in illness. So this polymorphism was a very significant, this is a gene environment interaction that uses genetic or genomic studies that to implicate nerve gas as a very likely cause of the illness. So you can see there's now a great deal of progress, and I think in the next year or two there's going to be strong recognition of this as an illness. But the question was posed is why did it take so long to recognize this? And I have a list of several explanations that are often stated, and I can't tell you whether these are true or not, but these are the things that have been seriously stated as the reason it's taken so long. The first one is that the government did not want to pay for this problem, and so they covered it up. Now, my own view is I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but that is often stated. Second one is this was the perfect war that got the American population out of the post-Vietnam slump. That is, after Vietnam, there was great division in our country about whether we should have done that, and there was a great anti-military feeling, low support for the military, and this was the first time we had a war that was strongly supported by the people. It was a highly successful war with virtually no casualties, a very short war, very successful, no casualties. And so it got the country out of the post-Vietnam conflict. And so the military leaders didn't want to ruin that by admitting, in fact, we had 175,000 soldiers with brain damage. I think there's something to that. Third, military covers up after every war. This is probably true in every country. The post-war investigations threaten the reputations made in the war. So generals and soldiers who fought in the war don't want investigations after the war because they might be incriminated and lose their reputation and their rank gained in the war. So there's a natural reluctance to investigate and a tendency to thwart or to cover up and not to investigate. National security officials did not want to confirm the effects of low-level nerve agent to our enemies, did not want our enemies to know that liberating low levels of nerve gas might incapacitate a quarter of an army. And so, naturally, they didn't want to talk about this. I think the most important is what in America we call crockism. Now, if you're from another country, you might not know what this means. A crock, in general medical practice, is the name for a patient that comes in complaining of symptoms with no signs. That is, fatigue, feeling bad, pain, joint pains, cognitive problems, and then they don't find anything wrong. The physical exam's normal, the laboratory's normal, and doctors are very frustrated by this and thus give it the name of a crock. And they disbelieve that these people are sick. They believe they're not ill. And so I think when many soldiers came back with this presentation, symptoms but no signs, the doctors naturally did not believe them. The problem is it was a quarter of the force all at the same time developed this, what we'd call a crocky illness. But the doctors didn't believe it, so why should the politicians spend money on it? You can see the reason that maybe they were not very enthusiastic. A post-war syndrome, after every war, so some soldiers come back and don't recover well. And so it's just expected. And so that was a reason not to study it. And that has been, actually papers have been written on that. A conspiracy by a small number of government officials to cover it up. And in fact, there have been small groups of government officials that have worked tirelessly to prevent this from being examined. But now, I'm not sure that's the reason that happened, but I'm not sure that's the reason it's taken so long. Scientific bodies, the Institute of Medicine, has been slow to deal with this and have actually worked in league with some of these people who were trying to cover it up. Finally, and military veterans tend to be patriotic, and they tend to suffer in silence. They don't tend to step forward like other constituencies do. There are some activist veterans, but the majority of veterans don't. But finally, it's just an extremely difficult research problem to deal with. And I would emphasize that really as, I think, the real problem. In studies of etiology and pathogenesis, in other words, what's the cause of this illness, the disease is, in most studies of disease etiology, and think of most medical illnesses, in trying to study the cause of an illness, the disease is usually very clear. For example, if you're studying coronary heart disease, the disease is clear. Cancer, the disease is clear. And so what you're trying to do is study the causes and the mechanisms, but the illness is easily definable. Well, in this disease and some other diseases, the causes and mechanisms are unknown, and so is the illness. So both sides of the medically or the research equation are unknown. And so it becomes an extremely difficult problem to study. You have to define the illness in some unique, creative way, and that adds, or that causes controversy and reduces the confidence in your studies. And at the same time, you have to then study the causes, things that happened months or years ago in a war for which they didn't keep records. And so you see, it's a very difficult thing to study. This is true of psychiatric diseases, depression, schizophrenia. At one time, nobody, 100 years ago, people did not separate those. It's only through over 100 years of research that we learned how to dissect those apart into separate diseases that could be studied. And we're still doing that. Okay, now what were the missteps, I think, that cost us all this time? First of all, immediately when the soldiers came home, because of the Vietnam War and the post-traumatic stress disorder phenomenon that was studied in Vietnam, the country already had a group of PTSD clinics and research centers all around the country that were waiting for these soldiers to come back from the Gulf War with a lot of PTSD. So when they came back with Gulf War illness, the PTSD researchers pounced on them and studied them and found what they thought was PTSD. But in fact, what they did is they misinterpreted their tests. They administered a large number of screening tests for PTSD, the Mississippi PTSD scale, for example, and they misinterpreted the results as true diagnostic tests, when in fact screening tests are set to have a low specificity. The specificity is only about 0.8, meaning of 100 tests you give, 20% will be falsely positive. Well, when they tested all these Gulf War veterans who had lots of symptoms, but not typical of PTSD, 20% were falsely positive, and so they found a prevalence of 20%. You see, now there are papers written on this, and in a short time I can't really, but this is a real phenomenon, yeah. This is a real phenomenon that caused a 5-year delay in meaningful studies. That is, the misuse of PTSD screening tests. And in fact, behind the scenes, they were doing the definitive diagnostic test, which is called a SCID, the Structured Clinical Interview for DSM-IV. This is a very rigorous interview that looks at the frightening events that would have led to PTSD, and found that most of them did not have an inciting event, a horrifying event, and did not actually meet the criteria. However, this information was withheld for about 5 years until it finally came out and they realized that it was not PTSD. And so then there was a period where they wrote articles and said, no, it's not PTSD, it's post-traumatic symptoms. Well, there is no disease called post-traumatic symptoms. And when that was questioned, they retreated and said, well, it's just deployment stress that has caused them to exaggerate normal sensations and manufacture an illness. So for almost 10 years, this was the explanation, and that prevented organic research. They began then doing large registries and large population surveys, really to kind of placate the veterans, but believing that this was really the cause. They barred the use of a case definition. No research studies could use a case definition because since there's no unique illness, it's just exaggerated normal symptoms, you can't have a case definition. And you know without a case definition, you can't study the illness. Then they compared symptom rates in deployed and non-deployed population studies, and this greatly underestimated the illness rates in the deployed because they were lumping all the ill deployed, which was about 25%, with the ones who were not ill. And so the disease rates were washed out, comparing to the non-deployed. And they delayed animal models of the most likely neurotoxic mechanisms because that was not involved, they thought. And they avoided any brain bank research because there was no brain problem. It was just a normal reaction to deployment stress. And the Institute of Medicine missed an opportunity to put the research back on the right path because it turned out the federal agencies were controlling the Institute of Medicine staffers. And so they were kind of leading the committees to perpetuate the myth. Well, turned out the way forward was not through government funding. The way forward, at the time this was all happening, some private organizations, particularly the Ross Perot Foundation, who's interested in veterans, funded some initial studies to form a case definition and do the right epidemiologic field epidemiology studies. And that led to the first case definition and the first studies of risk factors and the first brain imaging studies. And then more recently, Congress, interested in these studies, funded by congressional earmarks, which of course is a dirty word, but only through congressional earmarks could the studies be funded to corroborate these initial findings. Congress also mandated a research advisory committee that has looked at this fairly finally, and VA, and now finally, after all this is happening, the VA is finally currently designing their own confirmatory studies, and we may actually converge on a real understanding of the illness. But that's basically what happened in the Gulf War, in a nutshell. I gave you 10 large reasons that why maybe it took so long. I really don't think any of those were the primary reason, even though I think they were all true. I don't think they were really what caused this to take so long. I think what took so long was the difficulty in defining the illness, made this a murky problem that then produced disbelief. In other words, the prior probability, thinking in Bayesian terms, the prior probability that this was real was very low in the minds of the research world and the doctors, the clinical doctors who were seeing them. And so they just disbelieved it. And given that disbelief, all of these 10 reasons produced enough inertia that just nothing was ever going to happen. But it was only through work, really, of Ross Perot personally, I think, that caused this thing to be looked into and researched properly, leading to some hypotheses that were supported by good studies, and they're now getting the developing belief so that the government will actually study it. And I think in the next 2 to 3 years, we will see a diagnostic test where we will have brain imaging and very objective testing that will produce an objective case definition. I think we will see treatment. And when that happens, the VA doctors, the doctors who treat veterans, will read the literature and independently embrace this, and that will then change the culture of the VA and the medical community in this country, and they will do it. Anyway, that's what I've come up with is why it took so long, and Arnie, that's the answer to your question.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions? Yes, one.
I'm perplexed, and I thought that I came in late because I've been over in the desert myself other times, but looking at the signs and symptoms that are associated with nerve agents,
mm-hmm.
they don't match.
You mean the acute poisoning?
Or even if you look at what has been in the literature of any sort of chronic effect, which sort of goes against things. And then I think the biggest thing is sort of the misnomer of Gulf, the term, I think, was a disservice to the veterans, of Gulf War syndrome, because it is a number of different associated conditions. And when people were alluding, say, it's a syndrome, that implies a much simpler causality. I mean,
right.
I know that having followed it, tens of millions, I mean, probably hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent on this.
Oh, about half a billion.
And that started actually about 2 years after the war. Mm-hmm. So, how do you account for that?
Yeah, this is very confusing. And the literature, right now still, the literature has focused primarily on the acute effects, you know, the cholinesterase inhibition syndrome, which of course can be fatal. And most of the literature is about that, and the animal literature is about that. However, just in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been an outpouring of animal studies showing that low-level nerve agent acutely produces no effects other than cholinesterase inhibition in the brain, but then starting about a month out, you get changes in receptors and a number of changes that are likely to produce dysfunction in the brain. And now what we see from the human research is there are a number of studies now that show that there's not one Gulf War syndrome. There are actually several separate illnesses in this body, all of which seem to be related to gene-environment interactions between a complex mix of this pond gene that I mentioned, plus nerve agent exposure, pesticide exposure, pyridostigmine prophylaxis, and these things work together in different ways to produce several different presentations. And it's very analogous to well-known syndromes in people who are exposed to organophosphate, have poisoning from organophosphate pesticides. That's well known to produce a similar encephalopathy. And then the Japanese who were exposed in the Tokyo subway have very similar symptoms and now have similar brain imaging pictures to what I showed. So I think what's happening is that, I think you're right, I think your analysis of literature, current literature, is correct. It doesn't really tell us anything about this, and so it's kind of surprising, but I think what's happening in the research, the research that's coming out in the last 2 or 3 years and will be coming out in the next year or two is going to write a whole new chapter in this. There still is none.
But no, I mean, yeah. Tests mm-hmm. to detect. Mm-hmm. You know, these alarms, they go off if you draw the diesel truck on. But the thing is, they were confirmatory sensitive papers that, you know, would light up if you had exposure to a nerve agent, and they never popped.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but anyway, it's very complicated.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to reassure the other speakers, we're giving everyone 30 minutes each because we have one less paper than appears on the web version. So the next paper, where you're not going to be chased out without getting your full 30 minutes. The next paper, Vietnam, Improving Water and Sanitation in Rural Communities Through Capacity Building and Community Choices, by Dr. Ho Ha.